CliffCentral.com.
All right, there's some Rod Stewart to get you started this morning. And the reason we brought him into our consciousness was because he admitted that he had prostate cancer and that all men should be aware of this and do something about it. Get yourself and checked out.
You know, Gugu, because we were talking about older people. One of the... Do you know what a prostate does?
What does a prostate do? School me.
Well...
And why they're so, hung up on the prostate. Because, and Dr. Robin can back me up on this one, right? It helps to move the semen fluid.
Gotta watch out
so
for the
prostate. And it's always older guys, right?
Yeah, over 40. Hey, Gareth.
You. So it's what carries the fluid of semen and to ejaculate.
Okay. Good.
Do you see how it's always the older guys that are worried about that prostate? Why, Gugu?
Because
it's important to them.
Yes, very important.
What did you say, Gugu?
They want to be in action.
Oh.
Right, of course you want to be in action.
Yeah, but you also don't want prostate cancer now, do you?
No, that's why you need to go and check it out.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's turn from the ridiculous to the sublime. Do you want to hear Albert Einstein's voice? Have you ever heard what he sounded like?
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
So here he is talking about EMC squared equals MC squared.
No.
So listen, here he is explaining his formula. Google, you could do well to learn something from this instead of being an idiot this morning. Okay. Are you ready?
Hello, Einstein.
Yeah. This is someone like Google.
Just play the damn thing, Gareth.
It followed from the special theory of relativity that mass and energy are both different manifestations of the same thing.
Did anyone get that?
No.
Mass and energy are both different manifestations of the same thing. He's busy explaining his formula, his most famous formula, right?
A somewhat unfamiliar conception for the average mind. Furthermore, the equation E is equal mc squared, in which energy is thought equal to mass multiplied with the square of the velocity of light, showed that very small amount of mass may be converted into a very large amount of energy, and vice versa.
All right, do you know what that means? Do you know what the E equals MC squared thing is? Energy, E equals energy, right? M equals mass, and C is the speed of light squared.
Yeah.
So if you multiply the mass of something by the speed of light squared, you will get the amount of energy that it can produce. So stop smiling at me like an idiot. You don't understand a damn thing.
I failed physics, dude. I was like, no.
Clearly. Anyway, so there's some Einstein for you first thing this morning.
And with his lovely German accent.
Yeah. I mean, he was born in Germany. Yeah. And he says, he didn't say vice versa. He's vis versa.
By the way, that was none of us breathing into a microphone.
No, it was actually the recording. Yeah, there was that noise in the background. God, says someone, Einstein sounds like some of those dismal lectures I had to listen to this weekend. That's from Dr. Robin. 5th of November on the Cape Flats was the shit. You had 90% chance of being smeared with paint or smashed with a rotten egg on your way home from school.
Oh!
As this was the kind of day the kids who always want to cause shit had free rein, like the movie The Purge. I remember Guy Fawkes on the Cape Flats was a big thing too, Pumi. Families used to gather at night and everyone brings their firecrackers and got lit in more ways than one. And Bihlang saying, he's with you, Pumi. Guy Fawkes was bigger than Halloween in the village. In fact, I never knew about Halloween until I came to Gauteng.
Wow.
Even today in Sekukune, Guy Fawkes is the thing.
Oh, yeah.
It was all about dressing up like an old man or gogo and a whole lot of drag.
Definitely.
Oh, you got me a drag.
The category is...
I still don't know why Guy Fawkes is now Benny, but we'll just go with that.
No, it's Penny for the Guy Fawkes, because they would give you money, because you'd go from they'd give you money. They'd give you a penny for the Guy Fawkes.
The one thing I've never understood, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but Spring Day was also a thing.
Yeah, the water thing.
And I just never got that because...
Yeah, we never had the kind of water scarcity we have these days.
Celebrating Spring Day, you had to just throw water on people.
It. I don't know where that thing came from. It just happened one day.
Look, talking about celebrations, I loved how over the weekend some people were really being taken by the Bucks making it to the finals. That they were like, can you hear that? fireworks to celebrate the box. I'm like, it's Diwali.
Yeah, there was a lot of noise about that.
Sit down and calm down. It's Diwali. Oh,
there's always noise about Diwali.
Let the Hindus also get their moments.
Let them have their time. I love fireworks and on Diwali. We have quite a big Hindu community in my area around us. So we see lots of fireworks from our balcony. Love it. Thank goodness we don't live in the city of Cape Town.
Why?
Because they outlawed fireworks just in time for Diwali. Oh,
okay. I'm in two minds about these fireworks because I like seeing them. And don't get me wrong, New Year, I love wherever I am just checking out the horizon for all the fireworks. I mean, it's pretty and it's celebratory and all of that stuff. And all big cities in the world have a fireworks display. So I like fireworks, but I also don't
like
know.
Like your dog.
Yeah, I don't know that it's nice for the dogs or for the, you know. And there are also a lot of people who are very nervous about this. People who have post-traumatic stress disorder because they've been involved in like armed conflicts and all kinds of. There are lots of things.
There are lots of things.
I'm telling you, like it's a serious thing. And I don't know. Like there's got to be something better we can all do to not. See, first rule of trying to live in a civilized society is try not to make a nuisance of yourself to other people. And that goes for the people who are letting off the fireworks and the ones who are complaining. Because the ones who are complaining are also a nuisance.
Yeah.
And I don't like nuisance people. Like, there's nothing worse than a neighbor who wants to tell you what to do. If you're not interfering in your neighbor's life, they have no right to interfere in yours.
And in a multicultural society...
Yeah,
barring Sia and his non-communal ways, ways.
But let's be clear. Like,
we have to find a way.
First, do no harm, right?
We have to find a way that allows everybody to express themselves in the way. You know what I'm saying? We have to find a way. But it can't be one way or the other. There's got to be some middle ground. But the complaints on the groups, on the WhatsApp groups.
Yeah.
And when I read them in an accent.
Oh, yeah. I mean, me too. I know what you're talking about. No, they're complainers, and those people are as bad as fireworks. Like a dog reacts badly to fireworks, I react really badly to someone who's...
You know, the most horrible thing about your firework...
Is that Margaret?
Yeah, well, it's probably someone called Margaret.
Pick someone.
I don't know. Look,
you go. Build the police.
I don't let off fireworks, and I don't complain about my neighbors. Done. What a great neighbor I would be.
Complain on your dog's behalf, at least, Gareth.
That's something we need in the future, says somebody. Fireworks that are silent.
Soundless fireworks.
It is a festival of lights or festival of sound. Maybe they can make silent fireworks, says Carl. Yeah, that's a good point. And that's not my dog, Carl, by the way. That's actually Carl.
Even though, your dog is very smart.
Yeah, he would.
Not smart enough to text.
Tell me about Prince.
He can't text.
Tell me about Prince. Prince wrote a book. I love this. You know, when someone can cast shade on everyone else from the grave.
From the grave. This is Prince, y'all.
I mean, really, if there was one person to do such or was capable of such, it really would be Prince. So there's a memoir being released that was actually written by Prince. Largely was completed by a ghostwriter that he worked with, and it's available on pre-order right now. But Prince is just letting things off like no other. He had written it over the course of a couple of months when Dan Pipenbring, try say that three times. Dan Pipenbring, this is the ghostwriter.
I see your Dan Pipenbring, and I raise it one Costa Karavstavrakis.
They worked together over a couple of months just to put together Prince's life story into this book. And this is where Prince really wasn't shying away from just being honest about a lot of things in his life, including how he was not a fan of Katy Perry or Ed Sheeran.
Yeah, he didn't like anything.
No, not at all.
He didn't like any of their music. I love Prince. No. Even in death, he's able to rule over the music industry.
In the book, he says, "We need to tell them that they keep trying to ram Katy Perry and Ed Sheeran down our throats, and we don't like it, no matter how many times they play it." So, this is all part of his new autobiography. Supposedly, Dan was picked by Prince back in 2016 to work on this memoir with him. So it's not one of those cases where now the estate is trying to make money and here they are exposing Prince and his most private thoughts. Gareth, are you playing?
I'm playing a song by his sister, Tyka Nelson. He didn't talk about
what
her.
A tune.
He didn't talk about how horrible his sister's music was, did he?
Actually spoke about how horrible his mother was.
It's horrible.
Oh, I love it.
It's so auto-tuned. All right, so what did he say about his mom?
He said that his mother was really schnorrer, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, she didn't like spending money?
Didn't like spending money, but loved spending Prince's money.
Oh.
So because the mother had access to his houses, she would often get to one of his houses. And, you know, Prince had like safes and vaults in his home. His mother would access those, take money without even letting him know, and would never return it. So just freely used Prince's money, but never used her own. Also went on in this book, you'll find out things about the entire experience of how he came about to creating the Purple Rain album. He also speaks about his first kiss and why that was so important to him. Supposedly, Prince was really into animation and cartoon work. So this stand speaks about how in the process of writing the book, they made the secret adventure to watching Kung Fu Panda, of all things. And then Dan also, since it was largely uncompleted, Dan writes about his experience of being alongside Prince and also living with Prince throughout this time. Dan marvels at the likes of just how much Prince kept around him. There was one particular moment where he speaks about in one room they were sitting through his archives, and at a stretch of one arm he'd find a Momentum from 1979, and from the other arm he'd find something from 2002, and these were all like things from handwritten lyrics to like letters.
Listen,
from
he left
some
so much stuff. I mean, Prince used to, he was a bit of a perfectionist, right? I mean, he would scour the internet. This is my favorite story about him. Because you would never be able to, while Prince was alive, you'd never be able to find any of his stuff on YouTube. Do you know why? Mm. He would go and he would type Prince in on YouTube every night on Google and on YouTube. And he would find every link that had a piece of his music on and report it. He would do it himself. Sure. He didn't have a team of people. He'd spend the whole night. He wouldn't sleep. Go on, report every single one and have it pulled down.
Yeah, he was famously anti, like, all of his stuff. Or the rights of musicians being owned by other people.
You could not find a Prince song. Now you can find plenty of it.
You can find interviews, and this is what, that's the rabbit hole to go down on YouTube. His interviews of Prince throwing shade left, right, and center.
Love that guy.
It's awesome.
And he just did not care about who his friends were. He's not interested in friends.
And last thing on this, which makes me look at him in a very funny way, Prince actually loved driving. And Dan says Prince was an amazing driver. Can you imagine Prince in the morning, platform
going
shoes, going to buy
drive.
Milk?
Going for a drive. I actually can. Actually can.
Yeah. And I could actually see him, can. I could see him fighting with someone on the road as well.
What is Prince like in road rage?
So earlier this year, on the anniversary of his death, a whole lot of famous people put out with the hashtag Prince all their stories about Prince. And the best story, guys, the best story was from Questlove about getting a text, because Prince is also famous for throwing these big parties and handpicking all of the people that came to the parties. And it was some kind of like place where you got to network, and it was only the coolest people, because it's like all the people that Prince wants around him.
Yeah.
But these parties were also, you got a text or a call telling you about the party.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't one of those like Madonna type parties where you get an invite 6 months in advance, right?
You'd just be told on the day.
that brings an even more cool factor.
So Questlove gets this text saying that Prince is having like a roller derby party at some roller skating rink.
Of course.
Takes the girl that he was dating at the time with him. They arrive at this place and it's dead. There's nobody. There's no Prince. There's no one. and it's like 11 at night and they're hanging out here waiting for people to arrive, and he's starting to feel a little bit bad for him and the girl because now he's like, he looks funny, you know?
Sure.
Talk about the dating show. Yeah. He's now looking funny. Like, really, you brought me here. There's no prince. There's no party. And he says, as they're about to give up and leave, Prince arrives.
Yeah.
With his own personalized roller skates. And the people start arriving. He says, legit, the best party he has ever been to at a roller skating rink in the middle of the night with Prince.
I love it. That is cool.
You see, that to me is like old school
rock star
celebrity behavior. You know, there's not this celebrity culture of, nah, you can't photograph me in fluorescent
lights.
That you can gag over. But like, there's something about, who was it? And it's so not PC to talk about now, but old school rock star who would have little people trays on their head and cocaine on it. It's
Freddie Mercury.
Freddie did that. Freddie had a bunch of dwarves at every party.
Like, who does that?
Oh, great. God, are we about to go down a dwarf rabbit hole?
No.
There's a Vice link, guys, about a place in China, because we've been housed at China Ring, so China's like high up on my search list. There's a Vice, like,
okay, just
video.
Talk about it. Go.
Little video.
Did you have to say a little video?
I couldn't stop myself. In China, this kind of like Disneyland type called Kingdom of the Little People.
Oh, and it's just dwarves
everywhere. Amazing. Performing.
I would love to go there.
Oh, because you're so tall, right?
It's so awesome. Gareth, I'm going to send you the link. It's such an awesome place, but it's also such a sad little place at the same time.
Exactly.
The duality of it all, but it's...
All right. Gugu, what are you still doing here? You are meant to leave at 7. Get out.
I know.
Bring me Costa, please, Sia. And just quickly, some information here. This is, love how Dave Chappelle started his stand-up Sticks and Stones with a song 1985.
Yes!
Interesting fact. This has just come in from Taryn. Albert Einstein, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Caesar, and many other great minds were diagnosed with ADD later in life and were presumed to be on the spectrum during childhood. That's interesting. But not completely unexpected, right? So there we go. Some interesting facts. All righty. Are we ready to talk to Costa about his interesting life story? I am Costa. He's put out a book, From Meth to Marathons. And here he is. Having lived as a Greek boy, Costa Karastavrakis.
No, let him say it. Sit down and tell us your name.
What's happening, Costa?
How do we say your name, young man?
Karastavrakis.
You say it so well. I was driving here listening to you.
I've just got to look at it every time I say it. It is long.
And Sia, you got my full name right too. Konstantinos.
Right, very good.
Theologos is the middle name.
Wow. That's a good...
you can't become more Greek than that.
Theologos, if you break it down, means the word of God.
Exactly.
Mm. That's very impressive. All right, so first of all, dude, well done on the book. I am Costa. It's been out for a while. And it's a very, very cool story. It's basically your story, which I've heard tangentially. I managed to read a manuscript when you first started putting it down about this journey of yours, which is extraordinary, through crystal meth and your whole life falling apart. I mean, you started off as a, you know, happy little kid. You had kind of a, you know, like any kid, you had this life where you came from a Greek family and you sort of thought you belonged here and then you thought you belonged there, and somehow you ended up, like so many kids in the world, you ended up in a situation later on, not during your childhood, but where drugs entered your life. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm giving the synopsis here, but the most exciting part of this story for me is how you managed to pull yourself out of that, which is something very few people manage to get right, because, you know, most of it ends in tears and ends, which is sad. Mm. And now you're this fitness fanatic, and you come in here and you're running marathons.
Oof.
Yeah, making it very difficult for the rest of us to be lazy. So take us through the journey and tell me why you had to, this compulsion to write it down.
The journey started with school. And school was where I remember a lot of bullying taking place. And bullying is an insidious thing. It's something that switched me off as a person. I learned how to dull myself down, because being who I was, while it was normal at home, wasn't something I could feel comfortable with being at school.
But what kind of bullying are we talking about here?
I was calling names. I was the girly boy. Okay. I was also the odd one, the Greek one, the dark one, the skinny one.
Yeah.
And school can always, you know, isolate you for being something different. Now, while I was supported at home, at school I got some messaging, and I took on some incorrect messaging that it wasn't okay to be that way anywhere. Because it's so aggressive at school, especially for a 6-year-old. Come on, you know, and then through life, I just kind of got other messaging. Remember, it was the '80s. I was growing up all around. It was not okay to be gay. It was not okay to be this. It was not okay to be that. And you kind of take on this messaging incorrectly. So, in my head, and I found a little escape, started drinking at 12 once or twice.
12 is early. I mean, just hang on a second, because I want to dwell on this bullying thing for a moment. There are people, I don't agree with them, but there are people who say that a little bit of bullying is character building. And for some kids, it can be tremendously instructive, because it gives them motivation to prove those people wrong, also to grow their character, to not necessarily care about what other people think. But it can affect some people very badly. And the problem is that we must rather risk not affecting those who could be affected badly by trying to eliminate bullying, then take the possibility that someone will be able to handle it and it could end up, you know, motivating them for various reasons. I mean, Elon Musk famously said he was bullied horribly at school, hated going to school, hated as a result much of his life in South Africa, and wanted to start again in America. But it has, for better or for worse, been part of what's turned him into this monster of modern technology and this incredibly advanced entrepreneur. And I don't know whether that might have happened if he didn't get bullied. And we can only hope that the better angels of our nature would prevail, and that humans, if we were allowed to be nice to each other, would be nice to each other. But kids are mean.
Mm.
And some of bullying is not completely well understood. We always imagine that the kid who's being bullied would have been better off if they weren't bullied. But we don't know for a fact, because that's just what there is.
I know for a fact my being bullied has taught me resilience. I sit down now and I try and understand where my resilience comes from. And I remember it being a huge thing at age 7, 8, 9 years old, having to go back into the school environment. Every day you need to suit up and armor up and go back in there. And that did teach me resilience, something that I tap into right now. So while I'm not saying bullying was entirely bad, you know, I do think there weren't any anti-bullying tools that I had back, that you have now, that I could have had back then.
You were alone in the wilderness.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that aloneness is what got me confused. Is something that, you know, maybe I had a predisposition for addiction, but it definitely something that wanted me to zone out from those feelings. I'm allergic. Back then, I was allergic to my feelings, and the feelings it brought up for me were stuff I wanted to escape from. Had there been more tools, perhaps I would have said, okay, I'm being bullied, but I can perhaps handle it. There's other ways of handling it. Perhaps I could have started sport earlier. Fighting back is important for kids. I just didn't find the tools necessary. And worse, I didn't go home and ask for the help because I thought this was something that perhaps was wrong everywhere.
So how did you start drinking at 12, and where do you go to drink at 12?
It was a bar mitzvah, friend's bar mitzvah.
Oh, okay.
Sparkling wine was being handed out, and the first glass tasted really nice. And
who would have known that bar mitzvahs could be the gateway?
Right?
You know? So, okay.
And then 4 glasses later, I was blind drunk. And I remember distinctly enjoying the feeling. I knew it. Took a couple of months before I had another drink, but I had found something that felt nice.
And then you would chase it down, right?
It wasn't, because you might have got caught, so it wasn't something you sat and enjoyed. Famously, like I tell other people, I taught my cousins how to drink, so then I had company, and then we had a reason.
But I mean, South Africans as a whole, we have a huge drinking culture in this country. Mm-hmm. We, you know, our parents and we drink and around our children.
It's totally socially acceptable.
It's a very socially acceptable thing. It may be difficult to get hold of the alcohol, but we don't see it as that kind of terrible thing. You know, you're like, I needed my cousins to drink with, because like that's what you see it as. Mm. Drinking is about company. Social, it's about people around you and it's fun.
Oh yeah, Trivarsity. I mean, there I was a high functioning drunk. I was either working or drunk. Super easy to be an alcoholic at Varsity. Even at work, my first job.
Did you go to Rhodes?
Well, yeah, I've heard they're bad enough. Trust me, UCT was bad enough. But at my first job, I was told I'm not spending enough time in the company pub, you know, to raise your profile.
But hang on a second. I just want to just go back a little bit, because you're talking here about being at UCT, you're being a high-functioning alcoholic in your first job, all that kind of thing. So you're not an unsuccessful person during this period from 12 where you start drinking until you get to adulthood. You're getting things done. And this is what's scary, is a lot of people think, oh, well, your life just spirals out of control. You can immediately pick up there's something wrong here. This guy becomes a loser. That's not what was happening.
No. I had an incredible drive to do well. I wanted a lot for my life. I come from a family of ambitious people. Mm-hmm. It was all around me. I was inspired by that. It was a great time to be alive. You know, the early to mid 90s, I decided to start my own business. South Africa was changing. And yeah, it was something I wanted. I wanted to do well with my life, but I operated on two levels. My internal world was full of torment and pain, and addiction. And externally, things were, because of my will, my drive, things were good, but it was very difficult eventually to sustain that drive with only alcohol, and then I needed more.
So, you know, you talk about the two worlds that you lived in, right? Do you think that part of that duality is what drove you more and more into the substance abuse and kind of hiding in that place?
Yes, hiding the other world, hiding the fact that I was gay, that I perhaps had underlying depression, that I felt less than, that I wasn't normal. That hidden world is what I felt was a big part of, you know, needing some substances to dull out the pain, dull out the abnormal.
So you do a lot of work now with people around just sharing your story, but also kind of trying to help people as performance motivational speaker and all of that. Do you speak to a lot of people who also feel that way? It may not necessarily be hiding their sexuality, but some kind of hidden shame is one of the things that tends to drive people into addicted. That underworld.
Well, there's a famous guy, Gabor Mate, who talks about addiction being shame-based. And the neural network, the setup is pretty similar, that most addictions are born of shame. And most shame is perpetuated by being other than. So I love the way Pabi Moloi gave me a quote talking about othering. Mm. And othering is a big cause for me. So yes, a lot of people can access my story by just knowing that they also felt different, but that, you know, feeling different is okay, but feeling different and feeling bad about it is where it gets dangerous.
Yeah, I wonder if there isn't something we can teach kids at an early age about how being individuals much more important than fitting in. It's such a healthy thing. You know, the whole point of Western philosophy until the Enlightenment and following that more so was that the individual is sovereign and that you are special because you're different and because you exist as an individual. And it doesn't matter what groups you belong to, actually. I think it's a very powerful thing. And if kids can learn that early on, especially if you are an only child or any of those things that tend to make people feel like they need to belong a lot of the time. If you give a kid the impression that it's absolutely fine to be you and that you have complete control over your destiny and all of those kinds of things, and that your determinations aren't made by where you're born or who you belong to or how much you have or any of that stuff. It'll hopefully make kids a little bit more sure of themselves as they enter the world of adulthood.
You know, funny, writing this book, I took it to my publisher and the first iteration of it, they came back and they said, we need a rewrite. We love it, but we need a rewrite. And I was like, oh gosh, here we go. All right, I'll rewrite it. What do you need? And they said, we want more of this othering. We want more of that. Even in writing the book, I was still hiding these differences that that they felt, they said, need to be celebrated more. Tell us more about the Greek. Tell us more about the gay. Tell us more about all this othering that makes you unique. So even now in adult life, I, like you say, this individuality, something that even now, just unconsciously, I'm trying to just not portray as my asset.
Yeah, it's interesting. You've been conditioned.
Yep.
Like we all are conditioned to some degree to fit in. And it's that's a disease on its own. Like this need to belong.
Mm.
It's such a, it can be pernicious. It makes you do things that you don't want to do. It makes you say things that you don't want to say. It makes you try things that you shouldn't try. Right?
Yep.
So, I mean, I think we talk a lot more now about mental stability, mental health. We talk a lot more about it because it's so much more acceptable to speak about it. We talk about depression with social media and all of those things. Mm. I'm fascinated to know what it is that escalated your addiction. So you're a high-functioning alcoholic, but something switches for you and escalates you into other substances.
So it's a combination of trauma, and trauma can come from an abusive relationship. For me, that was one of the reasons. The other reason was a victim of violent crime, too, in fact. And
what happened?
Well, in 1992, I was hijacked on UCT campus and taken along by my hijackers and dropped outside 20 minutes later outside Khayelitsha. So that kind of kidnap environment, I mean, it's harrowing, but it just ramped up the drinking more. In 1997, I was raped at gunpoint by a policeman.
Jesus.
And that traumatically, you know, it was 97. I mean, there was no legal definition in South Africa of male rape. So reporting it was an issue. The shame around it was huge.
The policeman.
Never mind taking on the police force. And, you know, and then one day the pain gets big enough, or me not looking at the pain is too difficult, that I was offered hard drugs in my early 30s, and I knew all the warnings. As a high-functioning individual, intelligent, I know what it can do. It was a no-brainer. I was ready. And I said something that most addicts say when they try their first drug of choice, was like, where have you been all my life? It was like, this is it. I have found it. And I knew that first time I tried it, I was like, this is it. I want this. Like the first time I had a cigarette, that feeling was, aha. And then the neural pathway just lit up and said, I'm home.
Wow. You feel it that strongly, huh?
Yep. That's what it was for me. And I remember the next morning I phoned a friend and I said, we have a problem. I like it too much. I knew it straight away.
Wow. That's hectic, man. It's really scary. And crystal meth?
That came 2 years later. I started using my early 30s.
So that's the stuff that you actually, you like cook it in a little pipe, right?
You can. Yes.
How did you take it?
I actually took it up the nose.
Like cocaine.
Like cocaine. It's like a shard of glass that damages your
must
head.
It must be salt, but what does it do? I honestly don't know. I've never tried crystal meth. I would tell you if I had, but I'm curious as to what its effect is.
The way I describe it is you hand over all your responsibility in life and everything to something that tells you it's all going to be okay. Like you, that kind of feeling is bordered on spiritual.
Just, that sounds religious.
It bordered on spiritual. Like I said once, crystal meth's got this. I've got this. Just give it all over, hand it all over. I'm taking you along for the ride, and the ride is glorious. the first few times.
Really?
Yep.
What did it take you? Like, you feel like you're in another world?
You feel like you're in another world, but mostly that everything is okay.
Okay, so it's sorting out for you that gnawing feeling of not belonging. Mm-hmm. It's sorting out that gnawing feeling of not being good enough.
Pain.
It's taking away the pain of these traumatic events that you went through.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you're like, well, this is how it feels to feel good. Good Lord. Okay, that's hard to turn away from.
And but then it lies to you, because very soon thereafter, the downer is one of the reasons I stopped, because you've never felt something so painful in your life as that, is not that craving for more, but that just wanting the feeling to go away. And the downer is riddled with guilt and pain. And
how does that work?
So it's a spiral.
Yeah, I mean, you just pray constantly that the downer is going to go away. Please leave me. Please leave me. 2 or 3 days later, we called it Steak Knife Tuesday, you know, because after Sunday not stopping, by Tuesday you want to actually kill yourself.
Boy,
you feel that guilty. That that's horrible. And my downfall came very quickly. So crystal meth, I'm grateful for bringing me to my knees very quickly.
Very quickly, yeah, though?
It was a couple of months.
And what does it mean? Like you give up on life, you become a disaster, you start losing money, you start hemorrhaging friends. What happens?
Yeah, it happened for me over a few months. I'd been using hard drugs on and off, well, more on than off, for 3 years.
How old are you at this stage?
I'm 33.
Okay, so you're 33. You're taking a lot of this stuff.
A lot of this stuff, using my own money. I had.
And how expensive is this habit?
It's not. Drugs are not what's expensive. It's the lifestyle around the drugs and what you do when you're on the drugs that is expensive. You ding your car. You lose your phone. You cut yourself and have to go to hospital. Like all those things that happen around it. Or you make a stupid decision to go to the Durban July and you pay for all your friends. That's what costs money.
Sure.
More so than the drugs. But I was 33, spiritually like bankrupt, physically not looking great, mentally just messy, because the crystal meth takes over. And I was seeing things that weren't even there. I was making stuff up. I was looking out the window at cop cars driving past that weren't even there. So that downfall came when I call it like almost a possession, of my, firstly my brain, my mind, and obviously my spirit. I felt possessed by this crystal meth.
So Costa, you're describing a downfall from a pretty higher place.
Mm.
And what we see a lot more of in South Africa is we see people who are starting at rock bottom and falling into a very deep hole around, particularly with crystal meth, because it's so prevalent in our society now. What is it that bottom allowed you to find, and who was there to help, to hold out a hand to help you up?
That bottom was a place of desperation and blind fear. And that fear, like as a horror show, is what turned me away from it. You know, fear, they say fear and desperation should never be a motivator. For me, it's my primary motivator. The fear of that last day of using and the desperation I was in. I never want to go back there again. So, and it's a fantastic thing because it's a great motivating force. And it's one that I remind myself of every day, because it actually it motivates me to be who I am today, which I'll take. You know, fear and desperation get you this far in life, then I'll take it.
Almost like you told me the bullying earlier was a motivator.
That point. So it is it is a motivator for me now in a
all
positive
these negative
way.
Motivators you've had.
But if they move me in such a direction, like I say, I'll take them.
Yeah.
But the crystal meth feeling, it was the primary motivator, that downer. But who was there for me? A miracle moment. It's a spiritual moment. It's an awakening of some sort that happens. And who was there for me were my friends and family. And the community of other addicts, who are trying to stop using.
Mm.
So other recovering addicts, their assistance is without parallel.
So is there any way, you know, you're talking a lot about your negative motivators that are all internal. And I think a lot of people who've been affected by drugs in terms of seeing loved ones, seeing friends, family go down that rabbit hole are trying desperately to pull them out. Is there any way that a person on the outside can help, or is it all an inside job? You've got to do it yourself.
Well, again, I think Abu Matera says the opposite of addiction is connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, they've done those experiments on rats and mice.
Yep.
Where they put them into a social situation. The more socially stimulated the rats and mice are, the less prone they are to drink the water that's laced with drugs. If they are isolated and alone and do not have any connection, then they look for that drug and it becomes pathological.
Judgment is not what addicts need.
So in other words, does not help for me to say, ugh, you're a drug addict, get out of my way. I can't be seen with you. I can't have anything to do with you. You're a disaster. No help.
I know what we should be saying is, I know you've used drugs. I know you're high. Oh. I'm not giving you money. Here's some water. Here's a hug.
Oh.
I'm not giving you money. I'm not letting you stay the night. I'm not letting you steal from me, but I'm always here.
Oh.
Wow. A big difference to, I'm kicking you out. You are nothing to me.
And did you get that kind of support from family, from friends?
Oh, absolutely.
You did?
Absolutely, yeah. I was very, very lucky. But one thing I also did is I put the locus of control around myself.
Halala. Locus of control.
All right, explain
that's a new
that,
term.
Just explain it to people who might not have any idea of what that means.
It was all me. It was
accountability.
It was my mess. It was mine to clean up.
Hmm.
In fact, my parents didn't know I had used drugs. I hid it from them for many years. So I made a decision to tell them once I only got 6 months clean. Because I didn't want to tell them, oh, I stopped using drugs last week. You didn't know about it. It was hectic. I wanted to get some time behind me because it was my mess. It was mine to clean up. That's the locus of control.
Hmm. Sure. All right, Costa. So then you become addicted to marathons. Now, this is where I really start to worry about
it's
you.
It's a cross addiction.
I was worried about
everything else you
the
fine
drugs,
with.
But now you're a fitness fanatic and a marathon
it's
runner.
It's a cross addiction, dude.
I think marathon running is way worse for you.
Dude, the pain of it all.
So like, when people say, is it another addiction? No, an addiction makes your life unmanageable and is painful, and you have a compulsion that you can't control. Trust me, I do not have a compulsion to jump out of bed and run.
Okay. Oh, thank goodness.
Trust thank
me.
The Lord.
Trust me, I do not. Trust me, it takes some energy and some will and some strength sometimes to put those tackies on.
Yeah.
But it does border on obsession, but I'll take it. Yeah, it's a healthy one.
Yeah, and it makes you feel good when you're doing it and you're winning and you're feeling strong and you're feeling positive.
It's free drugs, endorphins.
The endorphins, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can get to the same level almost or not?
It's a
can
different
level. Can
you recall
what it felt like to be on the drugs, and can you compare it with what it feels like to be
pulsing
those endorphins through your system because you've run a race?
I can compare it, but it's on a different level. Okay, let's not bring sex into it. It's on a different level.
Wow.
The spiritual high you're getting, it can't be compared to the chemical high of drugs. So while the endorphins are working, finishing a race, finishing an Ironman, finishing that kind of high where you're crying crossing the finishing line is magical. And there's no magic in using drugs.
Does it for you, is it still a struggle every day, kind of fighting the darkness, as it were, and not going back there? Is it still a struggle?
I think over the years, resilience builds up. So recovery got me to where I am. Resilience is what keeps me here. And the resilience is because I have a whole set of tools. And I employ the tools. Sometimes I need them more than other days. But in general, it does get easier. But then certain things happen, certain stresses come, and then you can feel yourself wobbling. But I've been given a set of tools, and I use them every day. Check in with other addicts, help somebody else, talk about it, hand back the shame, say a prayer, write out one page of a journal.
Hand back the shame.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
There's a whole lot of shame that gets handed, that gets dumped on, that got dumped on me. That's not mine to take, not mine to carry. And when I hand back the shame, I literally wake up and say, I'm not what I thought people thought I was.
Yeah, what other people think of you is actually none of your business.
None of my business. And I need to remind myself every day.
Yeah. Well, this is a great story and well done on the book. I am Costa from Myth to Marathons, and a pleasure to spend some time with you and talk through your story. But I think for anybody who wants to hear more, go and buy the book. I mean, it's the kind of story that you really have to immerse yourself in. So congrats, dude.
Thank you.
And congrats on this this victory, because it's nothing small. It's a big deal. And you are out there helping other people, and you are out there spreading the word, and that's tremendously important. There could be somebody who's right now in that hole that Pumi was describing earlier and who could do with hearing this stuff.
Give the man an ad break. Where do you find the book? Is it freely available everywhere,
yeah,
or is it only at certain bookstores, select bookstores?
No, it's at 60 CNAs around the country.
Halala.
Bargain Books, Reader's Warehouse, Waterstones, and All Exclusive Books.
And if so you can't everywhere. Find it there, can you get it online?
Yep. Takealot has it. Loot has it. And then it's also on Kindle, Nook. All of that stuff.
There's no excuse why.
If you're overseas, it is distributed on Amazon in hard copy.
Well done.
Well,
that's great.
Done,
thank you,
Costa Karastavrakis. Costa Theologos.
Yes,
what a pleasure. All right, dude.
See, did you hear him say you got his first name right?
Absolutely. You know, my abuela's Latino. My
Stop it now.
In my past life, I was green.
You can't give him a compliment. This guy.
All right. Everybody, it's time for Blind History, episode 7 of season 2. It's brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. Here we've got some really exciting characters, the Krays. Now, criminals can influence history, change cities, become the story themselves. Criminals can be great criminals. They can influence all kinds of things. Robin Hood, Al Capone, Bonnie and Clyde, they all ended up the stuff of legend. The Krays were two London brothers who ended up owning the city and bending it to their will.
Two boys from the east of London, Ronnie and Reggie Cray. Their mum thought they were good boys, but they could and did deliver a bloody good beating. Those who got in their way got a smack, and those who called them names got a lot worse. There were rock and roll nightclubs, girls, boys, piles of money, and prison sentences. Two of the most notorious people to own London, who in the end were only loved by their mum. This story will take you into the real underground of London. And we're not talking about a tube.
Welcome to another episode of Blind History. We try to bring you a variety of people. It can't just be the great commanders and statesmen. It also has to be a couple of nefarious characters. The Krays were two brothers, K-R-A-Y, Ronnie and Reggie. I didn't know a lot about these guys until you told me about them.
So they were the most notorious gangsters London has ever seen. Violent, intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't have done what they did. It's crazy what they managed to achieve. Twins. There was a study done 4 years before the twins were born where they said that at least one twin predisposed to crime. It's guaranteed, 90% guaranteed the other one will be as well.
And they then proved this.
And then 1933, these boys were born.
All right, and so how did they start? I mean, were they born to like a poor family in the East End of London?
They were. So it's very important to look back at where they came from. So firstly, the father, Charles Cray, he liked to spend time with the guys. So he married Violet, who was the mom of the Crays, in Bethnal Green, which is East London. It wasn't the best place.
No.
And it was known for its villainry.
Mm. Charles, good word.
Yeah. Charles Cray was a proper smose. He used to drive all over the country, selling whatever he could. He loved money. And he would disappear for a week, and then he would come back. So Violet realized that was her lot in life. So when the twins came, she was so excited because she felt like a celebrity, pushing the pram around, the twin pram.
Mm-hmm.
Where the real learnings came from the twins – was from their grandfather on Violet's side. So Violet's dad.
Why, was he a crook?
So he was a boxer. So in that time, there was always matriarchies in East London. And the reason being is the men were either drunk or they were brawlers.
Or they were killed in the war.
Well, they were killed in the war. So they didn't last very long. So they were always having funerals. Funerals were always big affairs and in London. So
this is a horrible environment for these two to be born into.
So along came the grandfather, and he was a complete teetotaler because his dad was a nutcase, drank like a fish, spent 17 years in asylum.
Wow.
He would always preach to the twins that, look, drinkers out. And they never were any substance abusers of any sort. Ronnie became a complete nutter, but Reggie was actually very, very organized and straight. You didn't often see that where they got drunk or anything to that effect. So I think the grandfather made a difference. But the grandfather spoke about all the big gangsters that had lived in the Cockney area, and also spoke about Jack the Ripper, which was just around the corner in Whitehall.
So this was the inspiration for the boys.
Yeah, and the dad was also a handy amateur boxer.
Oh.
So the twins straight away thought of that. This is good news. And they used to sit in their grandfather's lap. But the twins used to fight against each other like two ferocious lions.
Mm.
And people thought they'd kill each other. But they never did. 10 minutes later, they were smacking each other on the back and the greatest of friends.
Mm.
And when the one lifted his arm, the other one would lift his arm. It was frightening.
So they were really in simpatico the whole time.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, very much in sync.
So where did their career start? Because I know they ended up owning nightclubs on the West End. I know they ended up being like in a protection racket. And we'll get to all their nefarious deeds later on. But you don't start off being bad.
So they did. So when they just grew up understanding that they knew how to take a beating. And they knew how to give a beating because they boxed from a young age. And I think it's quite important to realize that they were identical twins, but they got sick when they were very young and they had to be quarantined. It was the first time ever that they'd been split from their mom, and the twins had been split from each other. And it affected Ronnie. Ronnie then, after that, became very quiet. He was heavier than his brother. Whereas Reggie was always he was a talkative guy. He got on very well, loved the ladies. And from then on, Reggie was more organized and together. But together, they were formidable. It was incredible. And they started beating people up around the neighborhood at early age, 12 years on, and petty crime. But I think the big thing is they found an old billiard hall that they took over and made it their club.
Right.
That was the starting point. And people realized, look, we can use these guys as protection because they never lost a fight. Reggie could have probably been a British champion or a world champion in boxing. But, you know, he followed his brother Ronnie into crime. And, I mean, they never looked back.
Well, they made a ton of money and they lived these extraordinary lives. They met everyone they could have possibly wanted to meet. I mean, Frank Sinatra was a regular at their clubs. They knew he was a bit of a gangster too, it turns out, in the long view of history. But they really had access to everyone because these West End establishments were the kinds of places where the most important and famous and rich people in all of London society would frequent.
But they weren't in the West End in the beginning, so they ruled the East End, but they wanted to.
Right.
But there was a good old crafty gangster, Billy Hill,
yeah,
that ruled that side of the world. So they came along, and these guys weren't Billy Hill and his gang, violent. And they tried to fly under the radar, and they got on well with the cops. Along came the craze. We want a piece of the action here. And Billy's, no, you're not going to get it. So they beat the shit out of his gang, and suddenly Billy thought, these guys are really something special. So he was basically forced to take them to the races.
Okay.
And that's how they sort of squeezed their way into the West End. And that's where it started from their perspective. And then when they went into the West End, Ronnie felt he could express himself. He loved young boys. Whereas Reggie
was gay?
Yeah, he was gay.
Oh, okay.
So Ronnie was gay. He always had an entourage of young boys. And then there was also ministers and members of government, Lord Boothby.
Oh, okay. I read about this.
Yeah, so they were also gay. And so they hung out together.
And they tried to create a political scandal out of it, right?
Correct.
And the newspaper eventually got involved and published the story that Lord Boothby was having an affair with Ronnie, and Ronnie got upset, and Lord Boothby threatened to sue.
He didn't threaten to sue, he sued. And £40,000 was paid to him.
Hmm.
The government lost the case, and that really jolted the police. Once again, the craze had shown they could brush away from the law. But when we look at the Teflon Don, and we spoke a little bit in the last series about
John Gotti.
John Gotti. He was such a flamboyant guy that he wanted to show who he was. He spoke about all their secrets. Whereas the Krays were very clever.
Yeah.
They used to shut down people. It was very, very difficult to find them. They knew how to make sure that nobody talked. So they got away with it to a certain extent. But what the cops thought was, if we get a chance to lock them up for some reason, and then we'll get all the people to turn and we'll take them down. And ultimately, that's what happened.
But there are a couple of other characters in this story. I mean, I want to know about the detective who actually eventually managed to bring them in, because he's quite an interesting character as well. I mean, there's like George Cornell, who's the guy who Ronnie Cray shot.
Yeah, in cold blood.
He was a member of the Richardson gang, right?
That's correct.
And they were a rival South London gang. I mean, these guys really, they were like the great conquerors of the ancient times, except they were doing it just within the confines of London.
Exactly.
And this guy was killed at the Blind Beggar Pub, which is still there in Whitechapel. And the day before, there'd been a shootout at another nightclub involving the Richardson gang. And these guys just, they presided over all of this like they were untouchable. They pretty much owned London.
They did own London, and they weren't scared. And none of these gangs could match the violence that the two Cray brothers had.
Did they actually do a lot of the killing themselves?
So they did a lot of the beating up. So just to briefly go back a few years, they were conscripted, much like their father. And their father was conscripted at the Tower of London. That was where the regiment was. And he escaped. And that's why they never saw their father. But funny enough, the father wanted to discipline the boys. But the boys disciplined the father. They were so strong, they beat the father up. So then the father decided not to come back anymore. So Violet never saw Charles Cray anymore. But so they were conscripted. And so they came out to their sergeant in their jolling clothes, really all spruced up, shiny dancing shoes,
right?
Double-breasted suits. Where are you guys going? He says, no, we're going out. You can't go out. So they said, yes, we can. So they beat the shit out of the sergeant, and they dumped a latrine bucket on his head. So they obviously were very.
And they got to go out that night.
Well, they just walked out the door. Then they said, no, we're going to lock you up now in the military jail. And then they sent in the worst possible brawler sergeant in the army to go and teach them a lesson.
Yeah.
They found him tied up to a pillar, and they burnt a ring around his legs. He was screaming. He was yelping like a pig. And they walked out again. So they were dishonorably discharged. They loved confrontation. And so that was the focal point of the gangs. So the Richardson gang were just nowhere.
Yeah, they would never have been able to mount an effective resistance.
But what happened with this Cornell fella,
yeah,
he made a slur to Ronnie. And Ronnie was psycho. Ronnie was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. So he thought the whole world was going to come to kill him. And being as violent as he was, it was just a recipe for disaster.
So this guy just made some offhand comment.
Correct. But like offhand comment on his sexual preference.
Oh, right. Okay.
And so Ronnie was fed up, broad daylight, went into this pub. The bar girl saw everything, went straight to Cornell, blew him away. And he said that it was the best thing he could ever do.
Shot him in the head?
Shot him in the head.
Oh, my God.
And then he walked out.
And he said, it's the best thing I've done.
Yeah. And the cops came to find out, and nobody talked. So they'd wrapped them up.
Wow.
But later on, you know, once they were in jail, they all talked. They all sung.
Well, let's talk about this guy who eventually managed to read them the riot act, and that was Detective Chief Superintendent Leonard Nipper Reed.
That's him.
Of Scotland Yard. Who was promoted to the murder squad, and his first assignment was actually to bring down the Krays. He's like the, you know, the protagonist and the antagonist in any good story. He's like the good guy to their bad guys.
And refused to let go. He's very strategic. Because they were so closed in as a family, yeah. It was very, very hard to break it.
How did he break them?
So initially, he got one person to be able to talk. He turned one of Hill's compatriots, but Hill was now living in Monaco or some in Spanish villa. And he spoke. And they had enough to bring him in on that. And then when they did that, it was one night, almost like the Knights of the Long Knives, the cops came in and they arrested, I think, over 100 of these gangsters, of the firm, the organization.
No, they called it the firm.
They called it the firm. Based very much on the Mafia's Murder, Inc. And there was also an FBI guy that was in on it. He was inside, very close to Ronnie Cray. That was enough for them to lock them up. And the minute they did it, then everybody just came pouring through.
And of course, then they were arrested and they were put on trial and they were convicted.
Convicted, life sentences.
And they were sent to jail for life. But they did, I think, they were allowed out to go to their mom's funeral.
Correct, yes.
In like 1989 died. Or something.
So Violet died in 1980. They loved their mother.
Yeah.
Absolutely loved her. And she loved them and she never, ever scolded them right through their young careers. When people told her how bad they were, no, my boys, I don't think that's the right story. So when they, you know, they love, especially Ronnie, because Ronnie had problems, yeah. Mental problems. But by then, Ronnie had spent most of the time in the hospital under sedation. But Reggie spent every day training. He spent every day, kept in shape in prison. They ran a racket in prison, from prison, especially in the early years. Frank Sinatra was one of their clients while they were in prison.
Wow.
So they were protecting him. And he was one of their clients while they were in prison. And they were in prison for life. And the first time they'd get a look in on parole was when they were 65.
And Ronnie was a Category A prisoner. He was considered like the most dangerous man in England.
Correct.
Even behind bars.
Yeah, he was an absolute psychopath. And when he was behind bars, I mean, he nearly killed somebody again. So that's when they started just putting him on sedation drugs. So he spent most of his life, you know, half sedated.
Now, Ronnie, I mean, the reason I asked just now, are you sure he was gay? Because when he was asked, he used to say, no, I'm bisexual. I've always been bisexual. He wrote it in his memoirs as well.
Yeah.
He did have a relationship with a woman too. Her name was Monica in the 1960s. He dated her for about 3 years. And he called her the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen. He also is mentioned in Reggie's book called Born Fighter, where they talk about each other's relationships and all the rest. And as you say, because they were twins, they were so close, they knew everything about each other. A letter that Ronnie sent to his mother from prison also referred to that girl. If they let me see Monica and put me with Reg, I could not ask for more, was all that he said.
Yeah, that's always what he wanted. He never wanted to be apart from Reg. The big thing for Ronnie in his early years was he loved the boys. And he did state, and it's been clearly stated, that he's bisexual. Where Reggie, not so much. I think Reggie more than likely was heterosexual.
Yeah, he married. He actually married a woman called Frances Shea, and she committed suicide not long after that. So.
But that she couldn't live with him.
Yeah, well.
That was actually
Can you
was
imagine?
Crazy.
Huh.
But it's also, you know, the craze is a sad story to a certain extent, because you have the twins. First of all, Reggie could have been a proper world champion boxer.
Hmm.
Both of them never lost a fight. But Reggie was very careful. He knew how to wear his opponent down. He was very strategic in the way he did it. Ronnie just wanted to kill them. Then when Ronnie went to prison, Reggie flew. He grew their business. He grew the organized crime side. He grew their nightclub business, all the non-illegal parts of the business. In 3 years that Ronnie was in prison, the business grew 10 times of what it was before.
So if only, you know, they needed each other, but if Reggie had been able to do it on his own, it would have been a legit operation.
And he would have gone, if you can say that, inverted commas, straight.
Yeah.
If something happened like Ronnie died, but if Ronnie never died, Reggie was never going to leave Ronnie. It was not in his human capability to leave Ronnie. So that is the sad story about the twins, that there was really an opportunity for Reggie to live a healthy, long life
Of prison. Ronnie died first. I think he died in 1995, and he was already 61 at that stage, heart attack. And Reggie was allowed to go to the funeral, but in handcuffs.
Which is incredible.
Yeah. And eventually Reggie, he became a reborn Christian in jail, and then he was released on compassionate grounds by Jack Straw, the former Home Secretary.
Hmm.
And he, of course, died not long after that because of bladder cancer.
They died in their 60s,
sure.
61 and 65. But, you know, once again, like I said in the beginning, it should never have happened. They got so big. The mafia looked in and they said, we want a piece of this part. The New York mafia came in with their murder ink, and they directed the craze on how they should set up the organization. They had strong links. They were issuing false bonds in Canada. The organization, the money was pouring in, and then they had to suffer the ignominy of not being able to afford at their trial, when they're going to be incarcerated, a proper lawyer, because the money just dried up, because they never saved anything. So everything just dried up. But what was interesting, when they were in jail, everybody wanted to know about the craze. They wrote books. They were so rich in jail. They had so much money that went to their mother.
And the reputation, obviously.
And the reputation.
And there's still that reputation in London now for these kind of hard East End boys who, you know, are tough as nails and can handle any situation. They probably were the inspiration for a lot of what Guy Ritchie put into movies later on.
Correct. Yeah.
Hmm.
The Cockneys.
Yeah.
So it was...
yeah, Cockneys.
Yeah. And they absolutely came across London so powerfully.
Yeah.
They also, just interesting to note, they went to Nigeria because there was an opportunity for them to take over part of the country. They were going to have their own country. They had all these funny things going on.
What an incredible pair of boys
they
were.
They were just phenomenal. And their brother was in with them.
Charlie.
Charlie, yeah. He was in with them, but he was a softie.
But he also went to jail.
Yeah, he also went to jail. Yeah, he went to jail.
Most the softie in the family went to jail.
Yeah,
the good guy in the family was also in jail.
But they were, you know, when you meet somebody, you know, there's always somebody in this world that's stronger than you. And for the life of this story, they never found anybody that was stronger than the Krays. They decided to go out of their territory and open a nightclub. So almost, you could say, innocently, if that's possible. So they had the nightclub, and the local gangsters had no idea who the Krays were, and because they come from the East London. This is more central London. They came along, and they said, look, you need to pay us for the privilege of being in our area. And the next day they found these guys lying in a gutter. It was just incredible how strong and frightening. And these boys wanted to do it themselves.
Mm. They didn't have henchmen.
Exactly.
They did it all.
They did it all themselves.
God. All right. Well, I'm very happy to learn about them, but I'm very glad I didn't meet them in the streets of London.
Me too.
Thanks for listening to the award-winning Blind History, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. CliffCentral.com